But I think it was exactly 1 year ago this month that I finished a very long series on the character of King Saul and David. And those lectures were basically teachings or training for overcomer candidates. And my hope that every one of us wants to be an overcomer. And we saw through those messages that King Saul provided the negative example. In other words, here's how not to be an overcomer. Act like King Saul. And we recognize that all of us have some Saul characteristics in us, and those are the things that we must try to eliminate as we're growing in our spiritual walk. Saul is a type of the wheat company Christian, the non-overcomer. And then David, of course, is our positive role model. Joseph is another. And this series will be a little bit similar in that both Joseph and David are types of Christ. In their lives, both Joseph and David had to endure numerous hardships and suffer with patience and trust in God. We also saw that David, while he is in fact one of the premier types of overcomers, he was not without faults, was he? I mean, we saw that he stumbled seriously, spiritually, fell on several occasions, and we're going to see how Joseph compares in that aspect. Turn to Genesis chapter 30. The Bible devotes 13 full chapters to the story of Joseph. And there are not many individuals who were given that much space in the Holy Writ. David was certainly one of them. But so much space devoted to the life of just one man signals to us that this is a very important story. So that's one reason why I didn't want to just do one little filler message and gloss over everything. You know me anyhow. I like to get into the details. Probably, like many of you, the story of Joseph is one of my most favorite of all Bible stories. Is that one of yours? How many of you really, really like the story of Joseph? Many of you. Have you ever wondered why so many people consider it to be among their favorites? What is it about that story that we like so much? Well, for one, I believe it's because it encompasses so many features in the human drama that are common to all of us. Even though the story of Joseph occurred roughly 3,600 years ago, and that's a long time, isn't it, when that occurred, 3,600 years ago, we can still relate to it today. Why is that? Well, to use a current cliche, because the story of Joseph is about family values. We hear a lot about that today, don't we? The values and virtues within the family of Jacob Israel varied from person to person, just like they do in your family and mine, right? I mean, while men today generally do not have multiple wives, Jacob's family was what we would call today a blended family. Probably more than half the families in America today are either blended families or single-parent households. In our day, the blended families are more often than not due to divorce rather than to the death of a spouse. Therefore, many of us can relate to having a part in a blended family. In my case, I'm the eldest of 11 children, and our mother died when she was 44. I was 18, and my youngest brother, Jason, was 9 months old. Shortly thereafter, our family split up. Most of my younger brothers and sisters were parceled out to various relatives and to foster homes. So you talk about blended families. In my birth family, I know all about that. And even if some of us are among the roughly 50% in America nowadays where the parents have not divorced, there are still a plethora of features in the story of Joseph which strike home to us. We'll recognize and explore them as we proceed. But I think another aspect of the story of Joseph, which makes it such a powerful, gripping, and all-time universal classic story, is that the family conflict, which goes on for years, ultimately has a happy ending. And everybody loves the story with a happy ending. Every one of us can relate to a family conflict, and for those of us where it's gone on for years, we pray and we dream of the day that there will be a happy ending to it, don't we? But as you know, there were decades of domestic strife before the happy ending in the story of Joseph. So if you're in Genesis 30, the story begins here with the birth of Joseph. Now, to set the stage, Jacob, his father, has two wives, Leah and Rachel, who are sisters. He's deeply in love with Rachel, but on his wedding night, his father-in-law, Laban, had pulled the old switcheroony, didn't he? He sent his older and less attractive daughter, Leah, into Jacob's darkened tent, and he didn't know who it was until he woke up in the morning. Well, eventually, Jacob completes his work of about 21 years of service to Laban. He departs then with Leah and Rachel and their two handmaids, Zilpah and Bilhah. Zilpah and Bilhah become Jacob's concubines, and in fact, they're referred to as wives also. During a period of about 7 years, 10 sons and one daughter are born to Jacob from Leah and the two concubines. Leah is quite fruitful. She bears 6 of those sons and the one daughter, Dinah. As you can imagine, there's a great deal of friction among these 4 women, the 4 wives, especially between the sisters, Leah and Rachel. Although Jacob clearly favors Rachel, she is barren, unable to give any children to Jacob. This causes her great grief and resentment towards Leah. And you can imagine Leah's attitude of superiority towards her in return. Ha ha! I gave him 6 babies, or 6 boys, and you didn't give him any. You know, not that she would say it like that, but that's the attitude I can imagine. Rachel feels that the Lord has reproached her and shamed her. Well, finally, Yahweh answers her pleas and opens her womb. And we read in Genesis 30, verse 23, "And she conceived and bare a son and said, God hath taken away my reproach. And she called his name Joseph, and she said, Yahweh shall add to me another son." Joseph in Hebrew comes from a root that actually has 2 possible meanings. One is to take away. And so Rachel sees that with this son, Yahweh has taken away her reproach, her shame of all those years when she could not bear. But the birth of Joseph also gave her hope that she would have another son to fulfill her maternal instinct and to further strengthen her position as Jacob's wife in the fullest sense of the word. The other root meaning of the word Joseph is Yahweh has added. And so in verse 24, Rachel took hope in the birth of Joseph that God would add to her yet another son. Verse 25, "And it came to pass, when Rachel had borne Joseph, that Jacob said unto Laban, Send me away, that I may go unto mine own place and to my country. And so they did. He packed up." Isn't it funny how things pop in your mind like from years ago? So they packed up their belongings and they moved to Beverly. Jacob packed up their belongings, all his wives, all his children, all his servants, and he had a lot of them, and all his livestock, and they headed home back to Canaan land. The trip took more than a year. And on the way, Jacob encountered his brother Esau, from whom he had underhandedly taken the birthright some 20-odd years previously. And so now, being quite fearful that Esau still wants to kill him, Jacob splits up his wives and their children, each wife with their own children, and he puts his cherished wife, Rachel, way in the back with their precious son, Joseph, behind all the others to provide the maximum safety possible in the event of violence. And thus we see Jacob's blatant favoritism, which is causing jealousy and resentment among the wives. But do you think it's just among the wives? I mean, do you think the attitudes of these other 3 mothers might have rubbed off on their sons even at an early age? Hello? Does it still happen today that children learn attitudes from their parents? Jacob and his retinue of family, servants, and livestock arrive in Canaan land, and they first set up their sheep herding operation near the village of Shechem. About 2 years later, which is 10 years after the birth of Joseph, Jacob decides to move back to Hebron. Hebron had been the home of his father Isaac and his grandfather Abraham. In fact, at this point, old Ike and Rebekah are still alive and kicking back at Hebron. On the way back to Hebron at the village of Bethlehem, Rachel gives birth to that second son. Yahweh will add. She prayed for a second and the prayer was answered. Benjamin was born, but unfortunately Rachel dies in childbirth at age 45. Now let's turn to Genesis 37, where the main body of the story of Joseph begins. Genesis 37, verse 1. And Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. And when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him, and could not speak peaceably unto him. And Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said unto them, Hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose, and also stood upright. And behold, your sheaves stood round about, and made obeisance to my sheaf. And his brethren said to him, Shalt thou indeed reign over us, or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us? And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words. And he dreamed yet another dream, and told it his brethren, and said, Behold, I have dreamed a dream more, and behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren, and his father rebuked him, and said unto him, What is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee to the earth? And his brethren envied him, but his father observed the saying. Back when I was a young heathen attending The Ohio State University, I took a course called the English Bible as Literature, just out of curiosity. Even though my agnostic professor, who was a woman professor, by the way, still remember her name, Mildred, I don't want to put her last name on tape, but I know it. She had a great disdain for belief in Jesus, and she had a great antagonism towards the spiritual content of the Bible. But she readily taught and agreed that the Bible was, without question, one of the greatest masterpieces of all the world's literature. Now, there are numerous literary qualities about the Bible which make it the greatest. One of them is its compactness, the astounding way in which so much is conveyed in so few verses or lines. Just look at those first 11 verses of Genesis 37 that we just read. I mean, therein we find numerous revelations about the family values in the house of Jacob Israel. We find, for example, clear evidence of how Daddy Jacob played favorites. And here's one of those aspects of the story that make it so universal in its application. When one or both parents play favorites, it almost always leads to all manner of sin, jealousy and envy, bitterness and resentment, and that's just for starters. How many of you can relate to a situation of favoritism? Yeah, quite a few of you. When you're not the favorite one, it's very hurtful emotionally, isn't it? To use modern terminology, if it's really bad, it can be psychologically traumatizing. Or maybe you were the favored one. Was anybody the favored one? Oh, a couple of you. Well, that presents, you know, with, no matter what side of the equation you're on, it presents a full set of overcomer obstacles, which are really opportunities for spiritual growth. Joseph was Jacob's highly favored son. As it says in verse 3, he was the son of his old age. This statement has caused difficulty for some Bible students. They say, well, he couldn't have been even 60 years old because when he went off to Laban, Esau was 40, and therefore, because they were twins, Jacob was 40, and they spent about 20 years at Laban's, or 21, so he couldn't have been much more than 60, if that. In fact, he was 91 years old when Joseph was born. Well, now how do I know that? Well, it's easy. I read it in a book somewhere. Well, actually, when it comes to numbers, I did okay in math, but I defer to the experts. I rely heavily on the work of Ron Oja and Steve Jones. And then I want to see the proof of where they got it from. So, but in this case, Steve's book, Secrets of Time, provides a marvelous appendix which lists a chronology of events from Adam almost to the present day. And incidentally, we carry that book, Secrets of Time, as well as many other of now Dr. Stephen Jones's books on our literature list. So how do we know that Jacob was 91 years old when little Joey was born? Well, because we know that Joseph was 30 when he became what we call prime minister of Egypt, right? And there were 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine, right? And it says that it was in the second year of the famine when Jacob brought his family to Canaan land and Jacob appeared before Pharaoh. Joseph, therefore, would have been what? 7 plus 2, 30, 39. And in Genesis 47:9, you don't need to turn there now, but Jacob tells Pharaoh that he's 130 years old. And, okay, so Joseph's 39. At that point, I got stuck. And so I called up Ron, and he helped me with the subtraction, and we came up with 91. Jacob lived to be 147, which is interesting because he had Joseph for the first 17 years of his life, and he's back together, reunited with Joseph for the last 17 years of his life. We'll come back to that later. So Jacob lived to be 147. The Bible says Joseph was the son of his old age. Well, let's put that in perspective compared to modern male longevity. I think the average lifespan for a male in the United States is now somewhere around 76 years of age. So Jacob lived to be 147, and if you work out the ratio of 91 to 147, that would be like a man today who's going to live to be 76 having his son at age 47. So, you know, most men have their sons before that. There are exceptions, right, John? Oh, am I embarrassing? You're not 47 yet anyhow, I don't think, right? You're 46? No offense, John, but I would say that qualifies little Jojo to be the son of his old age. As we've noted, Joseph was also the firstborn son of Jacob's beloved wife, Rachel, and that Jacob lost Rachel while she was giving birth to Benjamin. What a bitter cup Jacob was given to drink. And thus we can understand how Jacob would have doted over both Joseph, now 17, and little Benji, who's about 10 years old as this story begins. We can sympathize how old Jacob would have been overly protective of them, how he almost couldn't help himself from playing favorites. It might not have been the right thing to do, but we can surely understand why he played favorites, can't we? I mean, being stuck with four wives, and he really only wanted one, Rachel. And then she dies at a very early age. I mean, he has more excuse to play favorites than does a parent who has all of his or her children with one spouse. Turn back to Genesis 35. In verse 19, it records the death of Rachel, and then it relates a wicked deed done by Reuben, Jacob's eldest son of all the brothers. Verse 22, it says, "And it came to pass, when Israel dwelt in that land, that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard it." Now the sons of Jacob were 12 and so forth. "Because of that evil deed, Reuben thus forfeited the birthright blessing." You know, it's supposed to go to the oldest son. Back to Genesis 37 now. That is why in Genesis 37 verse 3, Jacob, by giving Joseph the supposed coat of many colors, was signifying that the birthright was going to be given to Joseph. Many Bible students believe that this special garment was one which was woven of threads or yarns of diverse colors. I think of the colorful tartans of the Scottish clans. Now, I don't know if there's any direct relationship there, since the Scots claim descent from the tribe of Judah. It's right there in their Declaration of Independence from the 1300s. Others believe that this coat was made up of various pieces of fabric of different colors. And still others think it was a single-colored garment with multicolored embroidery work. Frankly, I'm not at all certain that any of them are correct, because if you look at that verse, the King James has the word "many" in italics in verse 3, thus indicating that the word is not in the Hebrew text. But let me tell you a little secret. The word "colors" is not in the Hebrew text either. The phrase "coat of many colors" is in Hebrew "kethonah pas." Kethonah means a tunic, and pas, P-A-S, means a hand, like your hand. Many scholars believe that this garment reached to the hands and to the feet, and they're simply assuming it was colorful, and that's probably correct. I'm not going to make a big deal of that. I just wanted to point out the word "many colors" is not in the Hebrew. Now, there's only one other place where this term, kethonah pas, is found. You don't need to turn there, but it's in 2 Samuel 13, verse 18, which is the story of the rape of Tamar. So that puts it in the life of David, doesn't it? And it says, "And she had a garment of diverse colors upon her, for with such robes were the king's daughters that were virgins appareled." This special tunic also seemed to imply that the privileged person was not much occupied with manual labor. He didn't go out in the field or the garden and do the heavy lifting, so to speak. You see, the normal tunic was either sleeveless or had short sleeves, and it only went down to the knees so that you could squat down and you could bend over, and, you know, these sleeves and long flowing skirt didn't get in the way. And so that's why they assumed that it was something for people of privilege. And by giving Joseph this special tunic, Jacob was clearly indicating that Joseph, although he was the 11th born of 12 sons, that he was already tapped for managerial and administrative work. This open and continual display of favoritism by Daddy Jacob was simply pouring more salt in the wounds of his older brothers, who had grown up knowing that they were the sons of the less favored wife, Leah, or of the concubines. And notice in verse 2 that young Joey is, in this case, tending sheep with the four sons of the handmaids, who ranked lowest of all the sons. So all the brothers already despised Joseph considerably. And then what does this 17-year-old whippersnapper do? Well, from the brother's point of view, he runs back to daddy like a tattletale. Verse 2 says he brought their evil report. Of course, this was the proper thing to do. Who knows but that Jacob may have sent Joseph specifically to be with them to report on their behavior. Whatever the actions of the brothers were, we can surmise they were not harmless juvenile pranksterism or practical jokes. The scripture defines it as evil. And whatever it was, young Joey chose not to participate in those evil deeds, but instead to make his father aware of their activities. After all, Jacob had already gotten into some pretty deep trouble with the local Canaanites up near Shechem because of the cruel actions of his sons, Simeon and Levi, if you remember their response to the rape of their sister Dinah. You remember how Simeon and Levi told all the men of Shechem that they had to get circumcised if they were going to have their one fellow marry their sister Dinah. And when they were all therefore circumcised and helpless day after in their recuperation, Simeon and Levi took advantage of that, went in with swords and slaughtered every one of them. But not only them, but their women and children as well, if I recall the story correctly. So given that track record of his brothers, it was proper for Joseph to report to his father on any out-of-line activities. But then young Joey goes and throws gasoline on the fire by bragging to his brothers about his dreams. Of course, since we recognize the overriding reach of the sovereignty of God in every human action and reaction, we know that everything that happened was part of God's overall plan. It was part of his plan that young Joey evidently be a braggart. There are some commentaries that paint a picture of Joseph as a person of virtually flawless character. It is true that, unlike David, Joseph seemed to have had very few character flaws. And if it is true that he were prideful and arrogant, it was a trait that was extinguished in him within a very relatively short period of time. Frankly, I don't know, and I'm not being dogmatic about whether or not Joseph had these character flaws at this age or not. But we've mentioned the book of Jasher numerous times in our various studies, and I must say that this whole story of Joseph is one for which the book of Jasher fills in an amazing amount of detail and explanation. The Bible references the book of Jasher twice, evidently as source material. And because of that, I tend to give Jasher a certain degree of credibility. Now, I'm not saying that I put it on par with the Bible as the inerrant Word of God. I do not. And Jasher nowhere claims to be inerrant. But I've read it several times, cover to cover, and I find very few places, in fact, I can't think of any, where it contradicts the Bible. It reads like a best-selling novel, highly engaging. It's a book you wouldn't want to put down. How many of you have read it, by the way? You read it? Okay.
Very detailed.
Yeah, absolutely very detailed. We carry this book on our literature list, and I've got some with me today. However, I must caution you that there is another book available from some Christian sources, which also goes by the title of The Book of Jasher. I've also read it, and in fact, some years ago, I used two issues of Feed My Sheep, our monthly teaching letter, to expose that one as an outright fraud. So don't buy the wrong one. And the way to tell the difference is that the bona fide, the good one, in my opinion, is the 1840 edition. In fact, this says it right on the side, Book of Jasher, 1840. The other one, if you look on the inner pages, it's 1829, I think. Now, the reason I introduce the book of Jasher at this point is because of the question of whether or not Joseph was always of nearly flawless character. According to Jasher, he wasn't. It says this in Jasher chapter 41, beginning in verse 6. Previously, the book of Jasher had just related how the 10 brothers were so strong and victorious, and they had just come from slaughtering a bunch of Amorites. And then it says in verse 6, "And when Joseph saw the strength of his brethren and their greatness, he praised them. But he ranked himself greater than them and extolled himself above them." Verse 7. "And when Joseph saw that his father loved him more than his brethren, he continued to exalt himself above his brethren, and he brought unto his father evil reports concerning them." We go to verse 9. "And Joseph was 17 years old, and he was still magnifying himself above his brethren, and thought of raising himself above them. And at that time he dreamed a dream," and so forth. And then it goes on virtually word for word with the passage
in Genesis. And so if the book of Jasher is reliable, Joseph may well have had some character deficiencies which landed him in trouble. And because God planned it all, his pride and arrogance not only landed him in big trouble, but it changed the course of world history.
Favorite children are sometimes spoiled children.
That's a good comment. Favorite children, I'd say usually spoiled children, right? Now, did the youthful and perhaps proud young Joey, did he know that this was all going to lead to changing the course of world history? Of course not. The illusion that he was operating under his own free will was just as real to him as it is to every one of us. We all operate that way. He made choices, just like we all do. He made some bad choices from his perspective because it got him into some little dungeon time, you might say, or pit time. But these are choices which God had planned from the beginning of the world would be the means by which the chosen people would become enslaved in Egypt. So, looking at it just at the human interaction level of the story now, we can see that young Jojo was either quite naive or his character was somewhat lacking at age 17, in that he may have been prideful of his status as daddy's favorite and therefore somewhat arrogant as he related his dreams to his big brothers. I mean, what does he expect when he tells them that their sheaves of grain bowed down to his sheaf? I mean, this only increases his brother's hatred of him. You can just hear them snarling at him. Why, that little twerp, he better watch his back. You never know when some wild animal will catch him and tear him to shreds. And you know, if that happened, I wouldn't care a bit. Sometime later, Joey wakes up one morning and says, "Hey, guess what, guys? I had another awesome dream last night. You want to hear about it?" "No," they shout in unison. "Oh, but it was awesome, dudes. Listen." Trying to modernize it a little bit. "Awesome, dude." In fact, according to Jasher, he tells his brothers and his father about this second dream at the same time. And so he goes on to tell them how the sun and the moon and the 11 stars all bowed down to him. How did Jacob react? Well, it says that his father rebuked him. However, we must not conclude from that Jacob was scolding his favorite son as if in contempt of the dream, because it says in verse 11 that Jacob observed it, meaning he gave heed to the meaning of the dream. Why? Well, because Jacob was well aware of the importance of dreams as being prophetic. He remembered how his grandfather Abraham had often told him the story of how God had spoken to Abraham in a dream, and how that dream was coming true in Jacob's own life. And of course, Jacob would forever vividly remember his own very potent dream of the stairway to heaven back at Bethel many years ago. So he was not rebuking Joey for the importance of the dream. Perhaps the rebuke was only for the purpose of trying to prevent Joey from getting more puffed up by Joey's own importance in the dream. And in this way, because the brothers were all sitting around listening too, Jacob might be trying to alleviate or mollify some of the envy of the brothers. But to no avail. Not surprisingly, his brothers grew all the more bitter towards him. Their mother, Leah, or at least the mother of six of them, had only died the year before at age 51, and so these now grown men had experienced many years of imbibing their mother's resentment and jealousy and bitterness toward Rachel and her sons. So the boys had many years of anti-Joseph programming to overcome. And they were failing miserably, weren't they? And Joseph, apparently, was, by his mouthy, braggadocious attitude, making it almost impossible for them to overcome it. Okay, have you ever felt that way towards someone? Resentful, jealous, envious, bitter. Let me guess. For most of us, more often than not, that someone is a member of our own family. Am I right? Mm-hmm. I was talking with a friend the other day who works in an office near our offices. We were just chewing the fat for a couple of minutes as we saw each other outside, and the conversation drifted towards someone who had recently wronged him. And so I grinned and I suggested to him that this is the way that God teaches us about forgiveness, by putting all those horrible opportunities in front of us. Now, this man is about mid-30s, living with a woman, doesn't go to church, I'm told he smokes dope, you get the picture. He's not what most people would consider your typical Christian. And so there we were, chatting about how badly he had been hurt and how he was wrongfully treated by somebody, and suddenly he blurts out, "And you know what, James? You know what's really the funny thing about it? Most of the time it's from somebody in your own family." I said, "No, that's not funny. That's not odd. It's not unusual. In fact, that's normally where most of our hurts and offenses come from, don't they?" And he went on, "You know, if it were some stranger, like got in some ruckus with somebody out in the street or in the highway or something, you know, if some stranger offended me, I could say, hey, no big deal. But man, when it's your own family member, man, it's really hard to forgive them." I said, "Tell me about it. Here I am, supposed to be a Christian and a minister at that." And then one day, about 10 or 12 years ago, I told him, I realized that I had hated my dad for about 30 years. And I went on to give him the 30-second soundbite version of my personal testimony on forgiveness, subtitled, "Could You Forgive God?" How many of you have heard those two tapes of mine? How many of you have not? Well, if you'd like to hear them, just ask. I'll send them to you. There's no charge for those particular tapes. As the title implies, it's my personal story of learning about forgiveness, but it's not really a how-to course, at least not in much detail. It's not a how-to course in learning forgiveness. For that purpose, we're now carrying a book. It's the best one I've seen on the subject. It's called Choosing Forgiveness. This is a how-to. How can a Christian learn how to forgive? And you know what else about forgiveness? You have to continue learning it, don't you? It's like patience. You can't ever say, "Well, I got that virtue covered, you know, now I don't need to learn patience anymore." And forgiveness is the same way. It keeps coming back, doesn't it? Back to Joseph's two dreams at age 17. We mentioned the number 17 a while ago. By the way, in Bible number symbols, and Ron's taught us this, what does 17 denote?
Victory.
Victory, right. But for Joseph, the victory could not come until he had, shall we say, run the race. Should we expect it to be any different for us, for you and me? It's also interesting to note that Joseph experienced two separate dreams which told essentially the same story, but using different symbols. This foreshadows the two dreams by the Pharaoh, which also told the same story, but with two different sets of symbols. So it seems to be the double witness principle at work here. Furthermore, when we ponder the actual symbols in the two dreams, we find that first, the sheaves of grain points or foreshadows directly Joseph's later concern with the grain of Egypt. In general symbolism, the sun, moon, and stars, or the heavenly bodies in general, have always signified rulership and authority. That's found among all nations, all people, and their symbolism. Whether they're Christian or heathen, it doesn't matter. That kind of symbolism is universally understood, and that's because just as the sun, the moon, and the stars are above the earth, so are rulers in high places above the people in positions of authority. Therefore, the second dream points to Joseph's ascension to a position of high rulership and authority. The Bible makes use of that general and universal symbolism, but gives it a very specific application, because in verse 10, Jacob exclaims, "Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee to the earth? And thereby he identifies himself as the sun, Rachel as the moon, and the 11 stars as Joseph's brothers. So if you count Joseph also as a star, there's 12 stars, right? Some Bible commentators say this indicates Joseph's and Jacob's familiarity with the signs of the zodiac. It's just for free. So, therefore, when we find these terms in prophecy, we have the key to their interpretation. And let me just use this opportunity to teach a couple of basics of prophetic interpretation. There are perhaps a dozen places in the scriptures where this term as a unit, sun, moon, and stars, is used in prophecy. We're going to look at just two of the more famous ones. For example, in Jesus' Olivet Discourse, as it's called, you know, when the apostle said, "What will be the sign of thy coming?" Part of that, Matthew 24, verse 29, says, Jesus says, "Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken." And then we have John giving this vision in the book of Revelation, chapter 8 and verse 12, where it says, "And the fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten, and the third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars, so as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise." I, for one, seriously doubt that these are going to be fulfilled literally. After all, how can one-third of the literal sun be smitten? If some astronomical body were large enough to smite one-third of the sun, then I want to let us all in on a little secret. It's all over. It's lights out time for planet Earth. All life would cease, period, the end. Of course, we know that in John's visions, many things occur on the earth after this particular vision. And so we can conclude this is not talking about some literal astronomical event. So don't get all upset about Planet X or Nibiru or some comet or asteroid or some such thing that's going to crash into the sun or the moon or the stars and smite one-third of it. It isn't going to happen. Since we can now understand that the sun, moon, and stars refers to the whole house of Israel, we can then interpret this verse as meaning that the spiritual light of the Israel people will be darkened for a period of time. As we know, prophecy can be interpreted literally or symbolically. Sometimes it's both. Well, that's the how of prophetic interpretation. How? Symbolically or literally. Then there is the when of prophetic interpretation. When will it be fulfilled? This refers obviously to timing. And when we speak about the time dimension, there are three possibilities: past, present, and future. And thus there are three schools of prophetic interpretation when it comes to the timing. There is the preterist school, as it's called. Generally speaking, they believe that almost all prophecy has already been long fulfilled. For example, a minute ago we quoted Matthew 24:29. "Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of heaven shall be shaken." Preterists believe that this and virtually all of Jesus' Olivet prophecies were fulfilled by 70 A.D. or by 132 A.D. at the latest. So that is past tense. Now, of course, everybody knows about the futurist school of prophetic interpretation, right? If you've accidentally stumbled across a Christian channel on television while you're surfing, channel surfing, you know about the futurist school. Because the they get all the ink and all the airwaves, don't they? The televangelists are constantly telling us that the Antichrist and the Great Tribulation are just around the corner, and that you need to send them money so they can help the Israelis build the third temple. According to them, almost all the book of Revelation from chapter 4 onward is off in the future, but not too far off. Moreover, the Christian bookstores are full of books about the soon-coming Antichrist, with a capital A, and the Mark of the Beast, and the seven-year tribulation, and the rapture, and all that. And there's this whole Left Behind series of books, which has now been made into videos. How many of you have heard those? Heard of them?
Heard of them.
How many of you have how many of you have read them? Okay. They are all helping to popularize the futurist viewpoint. But let's not forget, folks, those Left Behind books are fiction. F-I-C-T-I-O-N. And we carry Ron Poach's book, I Want to Be Left Behind, as an antidote to that futurist nonsense. Myself, as a one-time fundamentalist, I was taught the futurist viewpoint. I mean, I cut my prophecy teeth on Scofield's notes in his study Bible and on Dwight Pentecost's, interesting name, Dwight Pentecost's textbook, Things to Come, all about how the rapture and all that is the correct view of prophecy. In fact, I checked this week, I still have in my library several of Hal Lindsey's books. And so I pulled off the shelf The Late Great Planet Earth from 1970. And I had to laugh when I opened it up and I saw the title of the first chapter. What did it say? Future Tense. I have many problems with both the preterist and the futurist interpretations. The third alternative, the present tense viewpoint, is called the historicist school. All prophecy is not past, done, and over with. It's not all future. It has been in the process of being fulfilled ever since John wrote in the first century. It is really present progressive tense. Now, when the Reformation broke out, Luther, Calvin, and others recognized that the papacy and the Roman Catholic Church was and had been fulfilling prophecies all through the centuries. This was not good news for the Pope and his boys, because they were being exposed as the corporate Antichrist, the beast and the false prophet, and the man of sin and so forth, and it fit perfectly. It was kind of scary. The Catholic higher-ups got upset, fearful that their whole game was going to be up. They would lose their power, they would lose their position, they would lose their wealth if this understanding of the prophecies of Revelation got too widespread. Well, they were trying to figure out what to do, and it looked like they could not stop the distribution of the Bible to the common people in their own languages, since Gutenberg had just recently invented the printing press. And so they set about on a strategy to point the people in another direction, in fact, in two directions, when it came to how to interpret the prophecies. Using the just-founded Society of Jesus, which is called by what name today? The Jesuits. They very cleverly came up with both the preterist and the futurist school of interpretation. They applied the prophecies to deflect attention away from the present time at the Reformation, away from the present papacy. He can't be the Antichrist because, look, traitor aside, it was Nero. He was the Antichrist. He's been here and gone. It's all over with. It's all past. Or they point him the other way with another Jesuit who insinuated this doctrine and eventually got it into the Protestant churches, so it's all future. This Antichrist is going to arise as some world dictator in the future, and there's going to be a seven-year period of time where all the rest of the chapters of the book of Revelation is all squeezed together into 7 years. Now, looking at the state of the Protestant churches today, I would say the Jesuits were very successful. Would you not agree? Well, there are books available on the historicist interpretation. Howard Rand's Study in Revelation comes to mind. How many of you have read that and familiar with Howard Rand? There's another good one. I can't remember the title, but the author's name is Robert Carangola. I'm not going to go into any more detail on prophecy at this point, except to say that if you understand anything about history in the past 2,000 years, it's clear that there were periods of time when the light of the gospel from the Israel nations, talking Western Europe primarily, was dimmed. In other words, the sun, moon, and stars did not give forth their light. The stars fell from heaven, In other words, true Israel nations lost their position as rulers of righteousness in God's embryonic kingdom of heaven upon the earth. That's already happened. So that's just a little tiny taste of the historicist interpretation, which I believe is the correct one. Now, when we commence the second half of this lecture, we're going to find Joseph being utterly maltreated by his brothers.